Not very much.
Okay, I will call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 PM on Tuesday, March 26th, 2024. Present today, we've got Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Ortiz, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Kronk is in another bill hearing, so he will be here shortly. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones, and we've got two bills to get through this afternoon. First, we'll hear House Bill 259. And that is the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. And then we'll also hear Senate Bill 67, which is the PFAS bill. These will be the first hearings on both of these bills. So we'll hear from the sponsors. We'll take invited testimony, and then we'll set the bills aside. So first up is House Bill 259, Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. And I'd like to ask Representative Vance and her staff, Mr. Robert Bellinger, to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and go ahead and introduce the bill. And also, after that, we will have Department of Public Safety's Deputy Commissioner Brian Barlow, and he will be here providing invited testimony. And then we also have the chair of the Council on Human Sex Trafficking. And then we'll go to questions of the committee. Also, I'd like to note that we have with us Representative Cologne. And so with that, thank you for being here, Representative Vance, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of House Finance Committee. For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance, proudly representing House District 6 of the Lower Kenai Peninsula.
Bob Ballinger from Representative Vance's office.
House Bill 259 emerges as a critical initiative proposing to establish the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking permanently in state statute. The Council, established December of 2021 by Administrative Order 328, plays a pivotal role in combating the exploitation of Alaskans. By formalizing its existence in statute, the commitment to addressing the multifaceted challenges posed by human trafficking is strengthened. Human traffickers utilize force, fraud, and coercion to force victims into servitude and commercial sexual exploitation. Traffickers lure their victims with promises of hard work opportunities, safe housing, and the opportunity of a better life, then exploit these individuals in numerous ways. Indeed, human trafficking globally has surpassed the small arms trade and generates an estimated $150 billion in illegal revenues every year. One of the most common things that I'm asked is, how bad is it in Alaska? And so a couple of key facts that we know is that within 48 hours of young people running away, one out of three children are solicited for sex. In Alaska, the common age of recruitment is 14 to 16 years old, and the average lifespan once recruited is 7 years. One in four homeless women at the Anchorage Covenant House have been trafficked for sex, and that is according to a Loyola University study that was conducted in 2017. Since 2007, the Human Trafficking Hotline has identified 124 cases of human trafficking in Alaska, and 236 victims were identified in these cases. Nearly 45% of trafficked youth identified are Alaska Native. There is no typical victim and no typical trafficker. Victims of human trafficking can be of any race, color, national origin, religion, age, gender or gender identity, sexual orientation, or socioeconomic status. Likewise, human traffickers can be family members, diplomats, business owners, labor brokers, farmers, or fishermen. Alaska is not immune to human trafficking, and in fact, studies show that Alaska Native youth are more likely to be disproportionately affected by human trafficking. When it comes to the issue of human trafficking, I want to highlight this. This is a preventable crime. As a lot of times in this building, we only address crimes that we've heard of that have happened. But one of the main purposes of establishing this council and statute is so that the work can continue. one of their primary purposes is public awareness. Most people in Alaska do not know that we have human trafficking in almost every community. It is known that there is human trafficking in every high school in Anchorage. There is human trafficking in my small town in Homer. And in fact, Priceless Alaska told a story about three Filipino women who showed up in Homer at the laundromat asking what country they were in. Now, while that is a very distinct situation of trafficking people who are outside of the state into Homer, what is most common is our young people are trafficked by people who groom them online. The prevalence of online grooming has dramatically increased. And so I want to tell a brief story before I continue in the slides that highlights how this is reaching our young people and why it is important to continue this work. Priceless Alaska often has people reach out to them via messenger, text, social media, asking, what can I do if? They had a mother contact them that said, I think that my young daughter is engaged with someone online who may be trafficking her. Now, I have four young children, ages 9 to 20, two girls and two boys, and they play games. And Priceless Alaska told a story about a 14-year-old girl in Soldotna who liked to play the game Animal Jam. Very innocent game for young people that has pictures of cute purple tigers and things like that. And she got to chatting with another young person who also enjoyed Animal Jam. And they developed a friendship over time playing this game. Eventually, the friendship grew, and the individual said, hey, we enjoy playing this game. Let's go to another platform where there are some more fun games. And so they did. And that's when the grooming really took off. One thing led to another as the trust began to grow. And eventually, this 14-year-old girl shared photos with this individual. He then knew, the groomer then knew everything about her family, where her dad worked, where she went to school because of the relationship that was developed online. This 14-year-old girl eventually was coerced to go to a hotel and render services and deposit the money into an account. She never saw her groomer. She never saw her trafficker. And yet she was engaged in sexual exploitation simply because she didn't know that there were predators online who were seeking to traffic her. The importance of establishing this council and statute to continue its work is first to build a public education awareness that this type of activity is happening to our young people in Alaska. But it's so much more than that. And so I want to highlight that. But I wanted to give you just one example of how it's happening. It's not always the snatch and grab that we see on the movies. It's happening right in our homes to our very own kids. So more than a decade ago, Governor Sean Parnell created the State of Alaska Task Force on Crimes and Human Trafficking, Promoting Prostitution and Sex Trafficking. The task force coordinated with the Cook Inlet Tribal Council and put together the ad hoc NGO Working Group on Sex Trafficking in Alaska. The research from this group is foundational to the work of the current council. The first recommendation of this task force in 2013 was to establish a permanent working group on human and sex trafficking, a vehicle to continue the work of the task force. Unfortunately, this work was long neglected until Governor Dunleavy established the new council in 2021. The Alaska Council on Human and Sex Trafficking plays a vital role in the ongoing battle against trafficking that is otherwise referred to as modern-day slavery. This council operates on multiple fronts, starting with the crucial task of raising awareness about the pervasive issue of human trafficking. By shedding light on the deceptive tactics employed by traffickers, the council aims to empower communities with the knowledge to recognize and combat this form of exploitation. Additionally, the council engages in extensive research to provide comprehensive reports on the prevalence of trafficking in Alaska, offering valuable insights into the diverse forms of exploitation. These reports can help serve to provide a foundation for informed decision-making and strategic planning. The most recent report by the Council was provided to the committee as a supporting document. Importantly, the Council does not stop at awareness and research. It actively proposes solutions to protect victims. By identifying and advocating for measures that can disrupt the operations of traffickers and provide support to survivors, the Council contributes significantly to fight against human trafficking. Also provided to the committee as a supporting document was the Council's report from September 2022, where on page 5 of their report, their recommended action step was to enact state statutes that places the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking in the Department of Public Safety and establishes the Council as a monitoring body, the term for the Council, appointments, and duties. And House Bill 259 is a fulfillment of that recommendation. The Council will provide planning and coordination of programs specific to victim services, education, public awareness, data collection and dissemination, and reducing demand for human and sex trafficking. So they develop standardized data and annual reports, which the current Governor's Council is doing, award grants and provide audits, and increase education and public awareness. From a legislative standpoint, our aim is to facilitate a smooth and cost-effective transition to the permanent council. The intention is for the council to maintain most of its current membership and align its structure with that of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Additionally, the council will share an executive director with CDVSA, thereby mitigating the need for additional expenses associated with hiring a new director. This approach embraces efficiency and fiscal responsibility in the transition process. The structure of the 17-member council mirrors Administrative Order 328, with 7 members appointed by the governor, 6 commissioners and the attorney general, non-voting ex officio members of the legislature, and members of the public. The fiscal note on this program is about $333,000 in the first year, and then it is reduced after that, which pays for 2 new employees and the expenses of their office. As an ex officio member on the council, we deliberated on how we would have the work of the council in a way that would not be a heavy fiscal burden, but could continue the work. So we looked at other boards that share a director and came up with this model to share an executive director with CDVSA with 2 staff right now, to be able to kind of have a glide model with the support of the current Governor's Council transition to a permanent council. And over time, as they take on and grow in their responsibilities and duties, then they could come back to the legislature based upon their need. So the current structure of its membership mirrors that of CDVSA, so it's very familiar, and is meant to grow over time. We know that they would not be able to fulfill the same mandates that CDVSA is currently working under, but can continue the work that they are doing now and build upon that, fulfilling the public awareness campaign that they've been longing to do. So money well spent to ensure the council's permanence in statute is the goal. A step that signifies a long-term commitment to eradicating human trafficking in Alaska, the council's continuous presence will enhance the coordination, resources, and strategies necessary for effective response to this complex problem. By addressing the ever-present threat of human trafficking, House Bill 259 reaffirms Alaska's dedication to safeguarding the well-being and rights of all of its residents, and I am available to address any questions. But I do have Deputy Commissioner Barlow here as invited testimony to speak to the work of the council.
Great. Thank you very much. If we could have the Deputy Commissioner Brian Barlow go ahead and come up, and maybe if we can get your invited testimony first, and then we'll go to questions. If you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Barlow, currently working as the Deputy Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Public Safety and also Chair of the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. I don't know. I was mainly here for to answer questions that might not have answers coming from the good representative, but would just offer that I think that this is a worthy effort. The council has done a lot of work. We have a lot of experienced, passionate, and serious members that have come together and collaborate to this point and have come up with a good proposal, I believe, in terms of speaking specifically to the one director, two council model. We have experience with that in state government. We've seen success with it. We wouldn't have proposed it if we didn't think it would work as intended. Trying to strike that balance between being fiscally responsible and being effective there. So, again, just speaking specifically to the one director, two council model. The director, I know there's some concerns out there diminishing the effectiveness of the council on domestic assault and sexual assault, but I really do believe that will not be the case. This model takes that into account. We do not in any way want to dilute the effectiveness of either council and keep things moving forward to represent and care for the needs of victims of these horrible crimes in the state of Alaska. Again, don't have a specific testimony to provide other than that, but am here along with the rest of the group to answer questions that may come up.
Okay, thank you. We've got a few questions. I believe I might just start from the left and go to the right here. Representative Benjamin, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the bill coming forward. Obviously, this is an extremely serious issue, but I'm going to be just sort of candid in my comments. I'm seeing this for the very first time. When I look at this, it seems highly prescriptive, this whole bill. Select two members by majority vote to serve on a joint hiring committee with two members of the council to human and sex trafficking to recruit and hire an executive director. Do we have that statute for CDVSA?
Mr. Ballinger.
Is that language taken from CDVA or existing statute? If I might.
Mr. Ballinger.
Through the chair, Representative Ballinger from Bob Ballinger from Representative Vance's office to Representative Edgeman. That section is not in code, and the reason why that's not in code is that was actually, well, I said that statute is very similar to one that's used currently, I think, between the alcohol and medical marijuana boards, and it's designed to make it where the two boards can function together to select a director. And so that one would be new to the law because of the fact that it needs both of them to work together to select a director. And currently they have a director, so it would be the next director.
Just one other comment, and I preface this with my learning about this. It's the first time I've seen this. But my experience, a 17-member board, oh, my gosh, getting them together four times a year. Was there any thought to maybe reducing that in size and making it a little more nimble, more agile, making it I'm on the broadband advisory task force. There's 11 members on that, I think. And sometimes it's real interesting trying to get people together, although we do have regularly scheduled meetings now. But anyway, I just offer that as a sort of a constructive sort of first take.
Representative Vince.
Through the chair, when I first looked at drafting this bill, worked with the Council on Human Sex Trafficking, and took the governor's model on the administrative order, and then said, okay, how can we make it function in a way that is something that's familiar to the legislature? So modeled with CDVSA. Just in the year, more than a year that I've been an ex officio member, in conversations with members of the council, we realized, wait a minute, we need the Department of Labor at the table. Wait a minute. We need Department of Transportation at the table. And these stakeholders all have something to contribute in the area of sex and human trafficking because it's a much broader issue than it was originally discussed. And I know that Deputy Commissioner Barlow can speak to that more eloquently, but there are so many people who have so much to contribute to this conversation and really adding value to the stakeholders. In my experience, it's worked together very well, and many hands make light work, but each commissioner or appointee has added their insight into this area that has really developed great data and research and conversations moving forward. So I will defer to Commissioner Barlow.
Mr. Barlow.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, sir. Representative Edgman, through the chair, I would just add that your observation is noted. Certainly that is a large council. However, the issue that we're starting to delve into as a society or as a group, as a council here, it impacts so many different areas of our society, the world that we live in. And so, yes, there are a number of, it is a large group. However, we feel at this point we need all of those different viewpoints and experiences as part of the council to get a true idea, true representation of how broad the problem is in Alaska. And it is a bit to schedule and if you will, herd schedules and get everybody to meet at this point every other month. However, we've been doing that with some significant effort with internal employees at this point, internal administrative support. I will say that it's to the detriment of other work, and thus you see the request for a couple of positions in here. However, it is doable. It is doable. We've been successful for the last couple of years, and part of that is due to the commitment of the individuals involved here.
Okay, thank you. I've got quite a few questions. I just want to make sure I've got this right. I did just have Representative Galvin and Representative Stapp raise their hands, but prior to that, I was going from left to right, and I had in the queue Representative Edgman, then Hannon, Colom, Ortiz. Did I miss anyone on that first round? I don't see anybody. Okay, so the lineup will be Representative Hannon, Colom, Ortiz, Galvin, and Stapp. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm going to follow up on a couple of the questions that Representative Edgman started with. And on the construction of the council, how many members are currently on the Council on Domestic Violence Board?
Mr. Barlow.
And through the chair, I believe there's 11 members currently.
Okay. So, thank you. Through the chair, one of my concerns would be we've got virtually 28 people that an exempt service, and I do note that the bill has a transition language in that the bill passed, a new council, the executive director doesn't have to reapply, they would exist, but they go from reporting to a board of 11 one day to now being responsible to a board of 28, two different boards. And it seems to me that's almost a setup for a failure, for lack of a better phrasing of it. That's a pretty, you were hired to do one job, hire to govern a board, work for a board with a very narrow mission on domestic violence. And now the mission to have some overlapping, but a very different mission and concern. Secondly, I guess my question through the chair is to Representative Vance, and that is, your presentation is focused on sex trafficking, but when this the task force and the executive orders looked at both human and sex trafficking, and can you tell me a little bit more on the percentages of what we are seeing in response of how much is human trafficking, the three Filipino women versus one 14-year-old, and what's our scale of problem in two different arenas of human trafficking?
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Hannon. This is Representative Vance. On your first question, concerns about hiring, I'll let W. Commissioner Barlow speak to that. But on the issue of labor trafficking, which in by statute we would be referring to as human trafficking, distinctly different from sex trafficking, and hopefully soon you will be addressing the crime that distinguishes those. There has been little known about labor trafficking in Alaska until recently. And this year in House Judiciary, I was able to have a presentation where we finally got some numbers about labor trafficking in Alaska. And there were just under 100, I forget, it was maybe 92 cases of labor trafficking in Alaska. And so we know that it is occurring. You and I both know the fishing industry is one of them. Nail salons, ironically, is another for labor trafficking. There's a variety of means. That's part of the work that this council is doing, is gathering that data, say who has it, is it reliable, what do we know, and building those relationships. So part of their report is to build upon that and making sure that the data that we have is reliable. And so it's a work in progress. We know that sex trafficking is more prevalent, and there's been more research on that in Alaska. So that's why my focus has been in that area, but in no way to neglect the presence of labor trafficking. And I will defer to Commissioner Barlow to answer your other questions.
Mr. Barlow.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, thanks for your viewpoints on that. Certainly acknowledged. It is increasing the size of the responsibility for that executive director. I would just add that we did put significant thought into that, and again, trying to strike that balance between doing what's appropriate, what's effective, and what is fiscally responsible, looking at other areas of state government where we've seen success with this model, and also pointing out that while, yes, it is 28 people from 11, that the executive director primarily will be answering to the chairs of each council. I guess to assimilate it, I work in a department of hundreds and hundreds of people. Do I ultimately answer and accountable to each one of them? Yes. But my primary points of contact for that accountability are through the division directors. So my point being is that your point is valid to consider that. I would just add that we put significant thought into the proposed structure, and we feel strongly that it can work effectively and not diminish the effectiveness of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, even including language for a delayed start to ensure that the existing council has an opportunity to fill positions, get its feet all the way, ensure that its footing is solid before adding the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. I hope that's helpful.
It is, but I'm going to thank you through the chair, and I guess at the risk of just the parallel comparison of the Marijuana Control Board and the Alcohol Beverage Control Board being the model of we can do these two things differently, I guess I'm going to sort of try and remind us that those two organizations have the exact same mission about statutory regulatory behavior over business. It was just adding in a new business to it, the same commissioners, now regulating not just alcohol but cannabis, not a new council and a new mission. And so the concern being that, certainly my impression is that the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault right now already has a very full plate, and their executive director does a lot of extra work, and I don't want to see the straw that breaks the camel's back by taking something that also has a very important mission and saying we can just add that in and we'll all be good, because I don't think with the kind of not just the bureaucracy but the emotional nature of the topics they deal with, that this I don't want to see our Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault be put at risk by adding more to the plate when they are always struggling to just keep up. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Were there any comments before I go to the next question? Okay. Just want to also note for the record, Representative Kronk joined us earlier coming back from his bill hearing. And so next up, we've got Representative Colom.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, thank you for bringing this forward. So some of my concerns have already been expressed. And I don't know if you watched finance yesterday, but I'm fighting to get enough money for CDBSA. So my concern is we can't even fund what we have. I'm not really concerned about the fiscal note, the two additional
That's not my problem. It's that we can't even get the funding that CBSA needs. And I don't want to set something up and let the legislature just, like, let it fall. So I also know we have an executive director, which is a temporary problem. But to do this right now is going to be a big – that's a big lift for her. So I guess my question is, I'd like to get maybe some more background on why you felt like it should be with CDBSA and why not just have a totally separate council with a different management structure, just keep them separate. And my other one is they seem – a lot of the appointments and the missions seem very similar to CDBSA. So if you can help me understand what is your commission going to bring to the table that CDBSA isn't already bringing to the table.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Representative Vance to Representative Coulombe. Last year when I was working on the crime bill, there was a section that included these responsibilities of human and sex trafficking within CDBSA. And there was a lot of consternation that they are already overwhelmed on their original mandate. Mm-hmm. There was other concerns that while there is a lot of overlap, that the issue of trafficking is distinctly different when it comes to working with those victims and survivors. They do have very different needs than those who are experiencing domestic violence. One example that a trafficking survivor gave was the aftercare after she was rescued. In the facility that she was in, there were small shampoo and body wash bottles available to her in the shower. And she said that triggered her back to that place of trauma of being trafficked, because that's all she ever had available to her in those years that she was being trafficked were those tiny little shampoo bottles, because she would go from place to place to place. So that's just one example of how the needs for survivors and their care and the way that you work with them can be different from that of domestic violence. So we wanted to create a distinction. I do not in any way want to add more work to CDBSA, because they're doing a work that they've been doing a long time. We want to make sure that they're successful. So I talked to the sponsor who originally put that in and said, what was your intent? He said, I want someone to take up this work. So I began working with DPS and saying, okay, what can we do? We understand that we are under fiscal constraint. What can we do to get this council in statute permanently, because the work needs to continue and it needs to grow, because the council right now that is being absorbed by DPS hasn't been able to expand farther into the public awareness because of just needing the extra administrative support to be able to focus on this one issue. So we came up, we said, what can we do that can provide a glide path into a fuller council? And that's where the council itself began researching, deliberating ideas that would be successful so that the legislature could say yes. Now, if the legislature were to say, we want to fund a separate director and a couple of administrative staff, I don't think that you're going to find opposition to that. This was just a model that says, this is a solution for today that can enable us to get this in statute, because it is an important issue. We don't want it to go away, because the reality is that this work was neglected for a period of time. It was started under Governor Parnell, and then they did what they knew at the time. But it wasn't picked up again until 2021, and this council almost had to start from scratch with building the relationships, getting the data, and this work needs to continue because they are able to make recommendations on legislation. They're able to create those partnerships. And by creating them in statute, they would then be able to distribute grants. They could go and pursue grants in the federal government and make more dollars available, not only to support their structure, but also to provide resources to victims within the state, because it's very, very limited to those who are providing services to trafficking victims. And I wanted to provide just a means to be able to get the council going in a small capacity so it can grow over time. So I hope that answers your questions.
Follow up.
So with that being said, I guess so like one of the fiscal notes said additional funding might be requested for public awareness campaign, stakeholder engagement, federal authority to receive federal grant. A lot of that stuff, I don't know if this would happen, but it feels like it might create a competition between the two councils because that's what they need. They need money for public awareness campaigns, stakeholder engagement, and meetings. And so I guess it's not really – I guess my question is, do you think that's a realistic anticipation that as this grows that the two councils will just be fighting for funds instead of – or do you see them blending in a way that I'm not seeing?
Representative Vance?
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, as far as I'm aware, federally, grants can be very prescriptive, and there are grants that are specific to human and sex trafficking, whereas CDVSA deals with domestic violence, sexual assault. And while there may be overlap in grants, I think that what the Council on Human Sex Trafficking would be pursuing is specific would be specific to those who are trafficked. Mm-hmm. And I just want to ease people's minds that there shouldn't be a competition here, even though in the legislature we have to decide of where dollars are going to go. But the work is to help support victims. And creating that distinction is very important because a lot of times in the public, they will think that they are identifying domestic violence when in many cases it will indeed be human trafficking. So you're going to have people who may come into CDVSA and they realize, wow, this is a lot more than domestic violence. They would then be referred to services that are supporting those who are trafficked. So I see a positive partnership, but in no way a competition, and believe that there could be separate and distinct funding sources.
I have one last question.
Representative Colomb.
So would you say that most people that are being trafficked are victims of domestic assault and or sexual abuse?
Representative Vance.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb. We know that at least a third of traffickers are familial. And so, yes, it is likely first reported as domestic violence. And many of our reporters would identify it as that. But after, with us learning more about what exploitation looks like, are able to identify that it is indeed trafficking. And to another addition to answer your previous question is, with the model as proposed in the bill with a shared director, that should eliminate competition between the two, because I see the CDVSA and the Council on Human and Sex Trafficking as cousins. They have a lot of the same mandates and a lot of the same types of services. Their purpose is to help those people who have been victimized, and yet the end result when it comes to helping those individuals is distinctly different. So having one shared director will help disseminate some of that competition. Thank you.
Okay. In the lineup, I have Representative Ortiz, Galvin, and Stapp. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. And thank you, Representative Vance, for bringing this bill forward and this topic, very important topic that this bill addresses before us. Commend you on that. My question is probably, I guess, is it Mr. Ballinger? Okay, I'll start with you. If HB 259 would pass and we establish this Council on Human and Sex Trafficking, what do you think succinctly can you say would be the most beneficial impact towards our fight against human and sex trafficking? In other words, what's going to be achieved if we establish this council in the fight against human and sex trafficking?
Mr. Ballinger?
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, Bob Ballinger, with Representative Vance's office. Of the folks at the table, I'm probably the least equipped to answer that. As an attorney, I can answer a lot of legal questions. From my standpoint, just having I think that makes a good illustration, having a lot of other people gathered together who are the experts, smart people putting their brains together to look for opportunities to try to address the thing. But you have a couple of those smart people here at the table, and I'm not one of them.
Pass it off.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I love that question. I think the first thing that could happen is the work continues.
Keep going.
We saw, and I don't want to cachet, there's different priorities, and every governor can't do everything. But this work stopped for a long time. One of the first, and I'll use an example that really got me passionate about this issue, is I found out that one of the first recommendations of the original task force created by Governor Parnell was to put signage out in public places showing victims, hey, do you need help? Are you safe? And having the human trafficking hotline number. And one of the first primary places of transportation is the airport. So someone who worked in the airport, whose daughter was actually trafficked, was telling me that, hey, this is low-hanging fruit that we could get. Would you write a letter to the Department of Transportation and ask them if they are planning on initiating this? And I said, absolutely, this should be easy peasy. We can put signs in the bathrooms, and I've traveled in various airports where they have stickers on the inside stalls that are in different languages that say, hey, this is a safe place. If you do not feel safe, please call this number. So I wrote the letter, and it came back that said, well, yes, Rep. Vance, we're doing this, and we're including phones in these restrooms so that if someone's in a situation, they can call for help. Not a problem. And I thought, wow, that was easy. This is great. And I received a memo that said, no, they've done nothing. And so every time I would travel, whether it was here to Juneau, and I'd go through the Anchorage Airport, I would stand in the stall and look at the shiny, clean door, and yet there was still no signage anywhere about trafficking. And after 3 years went by, I started to get pretty upset because I would talk to DOT time and time again. I called the previous chair, and I said, will you be the one? Why can't we get this very simple thing of a sign that could save a victim's life? Because we know that our ports of entry are prime places for those who are trafficked. In fact, I had a former FBI agent tell me that they found one of our Alaska Native girls in Mexico. And it broke my heart that we couldn't, at a minimum, at least provide this signage. So I am happy to say now, because I kept knocking at that door and worked with the Council on Human Sex Trafficking, that when you go into the restroom now in the airports, you see a hand sticker that says, are you safe? And I have those available in my office. And they're now putting those in the airports and also planning to put them in all of our ferries in the Marine Highway System, because they are also a point of entry. The importance is that this work will not stop. This is an issue that is only growing with the expansion of internet and online exploitation. The victims are becoming younger and younger. Priceless Alaska says that their youngest victim was 9. And this is why I'm so passionate about this, is that we have to have this work continue, because it is not going away. It is only getting worse, and these crimes are getting darker. So I could go on and on about this, but I want to be respectful of the time, Representative Ortiz.
Follow up. Thank you, Representative Vance. I realize it's hard to be a I requested a concise summary of what this bill would accomplish, and I realize it's pretty hard to do that. But I think what I heard you say is that it would raise public awareness of the issue. That's basically what you're saying, through the signage that you spoke about.
Representative Bates?
Through the chair, Representative Tees, the purpose of the council is so much more than that. It could allow what this council would do with the administrative help, and being in statute would allow them to go get grants and distribute them and encourage more participants in providing the needs for victims. Right now, there's very little services for those who are trafficked, and this would open up more federal dollars and partnerships within the state of Alaska. It would provide for more data gathering and research to tell us really the breadth of the problem, and just kind of build out the support structure that we see within CDVSA. There's a lot of partners and people who provide these services. When it comes to sex and human trafficking, we simply do not have that in the state. When people call and say, hey, I need help, I want out, there are very, very limited services to be able to provide that right now. By establishing this council and statute, it opens the door to be able to receive and distribute grants and create those partnerships to provide services that simply are not currently there.
Final follow-up?
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, appreciate that. A quick question first. Is there any portion of public safety through state troopers or other facets of public safety under the commissioner's watch that specifically works to prevent human and sex trafficking? Are there people assigned to that? Are you aware? If I'm asking, can you tell me the answer?
Through the chair, Representative Tees, I believe that Deputy Commissioner Barlow would be better apt to answer that question.
Absolutely.
DC Barlow?
Thank you, sir. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, we do have members of our Alaska Bureau of Investigation, trained investigators in a myriad of different crimes that do investigate cases of sex trafficking, prostitution, if you will, with a focus on demand. These cases, sometimes there's information that comes to us where cases are built. Sometimes we're a little more proactive in our investigation. So is it, conducted to the scale that is representative of the problem? I don't believe so. However, we can only stretch our resources so thinly. So part of bringing this legislation into statute, part of that and the ability to go and seek grants to support many different facets of this problem could be in the form of supporting investigations to a greater degree.
Last
scripts and Ortiz.
So then in summary, my only question is, while in itself, you know, no one can question the value of the $333,000 or the $296,000 is an ongoing cost to support the council itself on human and sex trafficking, would it be your assessment that this would be the wisest way we could use these resources to fight human and sex trafficking, the most effective and wisest way that we can use these resources towards that fight?
Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. And my answer is yes. When just a month ago, I had someone reach out to me and say, a woman has reached out to me. She wants out of trafficking, but she has no place to go. Priceless Alaska cannot accept her because she has mental health needs, and they cannot address that. What the council can do in statute that it cannot do now is be able to go after grants and distribute them and work more specifically to providing these resources to trafficking victims. The current governor's council under administrative order cannot do that. The only other outlet is CDVSA. And as has been discussed, they have a full-time job. And we do not want to take anything from CDVSA. So this would open up more federal dollars. It is my hope that a lot more, depending on what is available. But we could pursue investigations. We could use these dollars to fund investigators, for instance, right now. But then when those, mostly women, often boys as well, but when those individuals are rescued, then what? So by putting the dollars to these resources, it gets things in the right order so that we are then taking the next steps appropriately and being able to have programs in place so that when those individuals are rescued, that they have a place to go so that they aren't running back to their trafficker, because that is often the case. And I want to make sure that we are not neglecting that very important piece.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Okay.
Representative Stapp.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Representative Vance, of course, Mr. Ballinger. So I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I will try to be quick here. I have three different questions. So first question is through the chair. On page 5, line 12 and 13 of the bill, you talk about two members who are mayors or elected officials in local government should be appointed to the council. Clearly, mayors are local government officials. My question is, the way I read that is you can basically have the Anchorage mayor and the presiding officer of the Anchorage Assembly appointed the same council for the state. I mean, I don't know if that's your intent. Do you want any type of geographic diversity in this bill in terms of appointees, I guess, the sponsor?
Representative Vance.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. Currently, the mayor of Anchorage is included. This was just simply to mirror the other language that is there. You know, I think it would be up to, you know, the appointments that are made at the time of maybe the need. So I think DC Barlow would be able to speak to, you know, the past history of this as far as diversity. But when we look at trafficking, our larger hubs are definitely a place. We see a lot of rural communities come to Anchorage. All roads lead to Anchorage, it seems like. So having the presence of these elected officials highlights what is going on in their community. But I also defer to DC Barlow.
Mr. Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stapp, through the chair, to be succinct about your question, yes, we do value geographic diversity in the membership there. Initially, the mayor of the city of Anchorage and the mayor of the city of Fairbanks sat on there. Currently, it's the Anchorage mayor and the mayor of the city of Kotzebue. So we definitely value that.
Yeah, I'll follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sam.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Yeah, the reason I asked the first one is because the way I read the bill is that it could just be two people from Kotzebue if you wanted to. I mean, it depends on the appointment. So my next question is to the sponsor. If this bill passes, this council extension also says they include public meetings, and, of course, they have a minimum of one meeting per quarter on line 6. Do you foresee this commission or this board meeting more times than they currently do after they're combined, or less times? Do you think there'll be more, including more public meetings, or less than current?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think that currently what's happening, we do have subcommittees that meet outside of the regular meetings to be able to accomplish some of the tasks that are worked on. So that does occur. It would just depend on, you know, what their objectives are at the time. But again, I think DC Barlow would be able to speak to maybe what the history has been.
Mr. Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stapp, through the chair, I think with any major endeavor at the beginning, your I guess the quantity or rate of meetings is going to be greater as you establish what your efforts are going to be and your focuses. Certainly that would be the case here, but I think that over time it would reduce. It's already begun to reduce, and we're not in statute yet. That would probably ebb and flow throughout time as other efforts spool up, like grants, seeking grants and focuses on certain prongs of what the council wants to accomplish. Again, we would meet quarterly. There could be more meetings based on need at the advice of the chair, but I think it kind of remains to be seen based on what business is being focused on.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster, a quick follow-up to that, and then I'll ask my final question. Follow up through the chair. The reason I asked the question is because the bill entitles all members of the commission, all 17 members, not only for travel expenses, but for per diem, right? And that is not accounted for in any of the fiscal notes we have for the bill. So if we assume that these 17 members who are all going to be entitled for per diem and travel expenses are going to meet more frequently than they currently do, we should also assume that that is going to cost us more money. Maybe the department can absorb all that cost, but there's no relevant fiscal note regarding the per diem and their and the travel expenses reimbursement through all the members, even in the other department fiscal notes, right, which I think we'll get into the later bill. So my last follow-up is going to be regarding the positions within DPS itself. So DPS has a ton of vacancies, huge amount of salary savings. So my question is, why not simply just reclassify existing positions that you do not have to fill, that you can't have not been able to fill for multi-years at this point, rather than adding new positions when you have a huge vacancy factor in the department's budget already? I don't know if you can answer that. I don't know if that conversation was had. So,
Mr. Barlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Snapp, through the chair, true, number of vacancies. However, I don't want to get too out in front of my skis here, but in front of the commissioner, however, our endeavor daily is to fill the vacancies that we have. We're endeavoring to make progress on that. And again, we're trying to come up with a realistic structure for something new in the department, an effort that goes statewide. And if I could, just a comment to your previous discussion about meetings and per diem, a valid point. We do meet in person once per year. However, take advantage of technologies. By and large, the meetings are via Teams or Zoom or some other type of technology in an effort to be fiscally responsible.
Yeah, and my last one. Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. No, I don't doubt that. I've just said there's nothing in the bill that dictates that any of your meetings should be over Zoom. There's definitely language in the bill that says, hey, when practicable. But again, if you're going to be having public meetings, that's going to be up in terms of the interpretation of council. That's why I asked the question. So appreciate it.
Okay. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, firstly, I want to thank you, Representative Vance. This is a heartbreaking issue to have to address, and I know that you've spent a lot of time helping to bring this forward. Thank you. And my questions are related to some of the atrocious data that I've seen. I want to help get my head wrapped around how big of an issue this is. I want to make sure I'm reading this properly. I have 14 to 16-year-olds is the typical age of recruitment. I want to get confirmation on that. And then the other is in Alaska. I think what I read was there have been 124 cases since 2007 reported to the hotline. So is that roughly about 18 per year on average where we are with that?
Representative Vance.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, this is Representative Vance. Thank you for your acknowledgement of the work. I am a recent cheerleader to all the people who have been working on this quite some time. The numbers don't really average out. When the federal government first passed its trafficking laws, Alaska was the first place for one of the biggest busts, and there were quite a few victims in that. So the number ebbs and flows. So I don't want you to think that maybe there's a consistent number every year.
Thank you. I think that helps to appreciate that it's just tricky. And I'm thinking about the DVSA victims and the trafficking victims. I know there's a tiny bit of overlap, but I think of the DVSA number of victims, given what I've heard of the data there, that it's huge. And I'm sure that we probably wouldn't want to call this a subset since it sometimes does not overlap. But in the past, the group that you're working with, have they been working within the DVSA universe? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. The answer is yes. There's a lot of partnerships, and they have to have the partnerships because of just the nature of what this is. So whether it's domestic violence or sex trafficking, exploitation, it's violence. It's sexual violence. It's domestic violence is involved. So there's incredible overlap. Mm-hmm. The only way they're able to succeed is through these partnerships. So what we're seeing with understanding more of what trafficking looks like and what it looks like in Alaska, we're finding that it exists more than what we realize. No one will identify and say, hey, I'm being trafficked. They just don't do that. They're in that place of heavy trauma. I have a close friend of mine who has been walking through her trauma. And as I was creating the trifold out of my office to just bring awareness to my own community, she was reading through the steps of exploitation, the grooming, the coercion, things like that. And she realized that her situation, which she originally thought was domestic violence alone, she realized that she was being groomed, and the last thing on the list was commercial exploitation. She did not meet that because she was able to get out of that situation just prior to that. But every other step, she was able to check off the box. So the more that we understand what sexual exploitation looks like, the more people are going to go, oh my goodness, this is my friend that I've been trying to help in their situation. Mm-hmm. Or this was me in my past situation that I didn't realize that it was to that level. So this is part of the work that the council is doing, is really identifying that and helping those partners be able to see what it is and help them in their need. Because the follow-up for their specific services that they're going to need is tailored differently than someone who was just in a domestic violence situation or sexual assault, because exploitation takes on that human slavery aspect.
Representative Galvin?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So what I'm trying to get my head wrapped around is how these two universes are overlapping to the point of what we heard from Representative Colom, like there's some understanding that they are going to, if we put these two together, will there be kind of a jockeying for resources? Are they separate sorts of resources? And as I'm thinking through this, I think about things like what's happening in, for example, early learning. And we know, and something similar was tried to be put together. I think you're probably familiar back in the day of Governor Parnell as well, where it was a huge, they tried to do the same thing. I'm sure that Representative Edgman remembers, with all the commissioners being asked to show up 4 times a year. You know, it's really a big ask. And so as I'm thinking through this, it does make sense to me with early learning, you have a set of important advocates and care providers who are doing things around ACEs and, you know, severe issues that would involve OCS, et cetera. And then there's other pieces of this, which is helping families to be strong and what that looks like and how. And so to me, that this almost feels like a subset, but I don't know enough about it, and I'm learning. I do know that what I heard from you is that public awareness is the number one element of getting word out, that you'd like to do better, and you've already done some of your own public awareness, and that funds need to go to that. And so I appreciate that you need to form something in order to make that happen. And I'm supportive of that, and I hope that we can make that happen. But how it looks, I can appreciate concerns about the size of it. The other question I had specific is not just the 17 member, but in particular one member I see on page 5 of the bill, letter C, is one member represents an Alaska Native organization. It's sort of a general statement. And then looking at your data, you have that currently 45% of trafficked youth are identified as Alaska Native. So I assume that this was specifically designed in order to ensure that you have input from that organization. And I guess my question to you is whether you had considered more members representing a population which you think is more vulnerable, or, you know, kind of what the thinking was on as you made that decision.
Representative Betts.
Chair, I love this. I can talk about this all day long. But I Representative Galvin, through the chair, yes, this with the Alaska Native organization was broad enough so that it could encompass the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, for instance. You know, there's a variety of organizations. Definitely want them represented. Again, this is not my model. This is the work of the council and the other, you know, known systems in place like CDDSA and the current structure of the council. So this is not my will. This is the will of the current Council on Human Sex Trafficking that came together and said, this is what we want. Work closely with DPS on what is appropriate. So I want to make it very clear that the way that this is structured is not what I came up with. I fully embrace and endorse this and think that this is a good piece of legislation, although Representative Stepp raised some fiduciary concerns that we definitely, I think, is appropriate to address. But as far as the membership, this is a model that has been working well. And these members and my participation on this council, I am so amazed by everyone who comes to the table has a certain joy and dedication to this work. And they've been doing it with no extra money in DPS. And some of these people have been at this for a very long time and bringing things to the table. So I just want to say that the current structure is working and everyone's working well. I haven't heard any complaints about certain members not being at the table. It's been, oh my goodness, why haven't we had Department of Law and Department of Transportation at the table? And they said, yes, we want to be a part of the conversation. So I'm open to what the recommendations of this committee are, but I will refer to Deputy Commissioner Barlow on specific to the outlay of this membership.
Follow up?
Mr. Barlow, if you wanted to maybe reply first, and then we'll go to Representative Galvin, then after we maybe answer or ask another question, I'd like to at least give 45 minutes to the next bill. So we should, these are just introductions. These are not the last hearings, of course. So, Mr. Barlow.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Brian Barlow, Chair of the Governor's Council on Human and Sex Trafficking. Representative Galvin, through the chair, I guess along the lines of what Representative Vance provided, this is the structure that we were handed in the initial order, and we've been working within that structure. I agree that it's been effective. I also think that as time moves on, should we find ourselves in statute and pursuing funding and pursuing specific actions regarding education or victim services or education on many levels, it may drive a need for different types or different level of representation on the council in a certain area, such as the Alaska Native voice. So we'll always be open to that and evaluating that, if that's helpful.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So firstly, I'm curious to know how you identify or define effective, because I've heard you both say it's already been very effective. So I'm curious to know what that looks like in your mind. I'm hearing numbers are getting worse, and so I'm okay. Concerned. Yeah. Maybe the group is working together effectively, but
thank you.
What does that mean in terms of overall outcomes, population outcomes, et cetera? And if you could comment on that. And secondly, I'm just going to add, when I saw the Alaska Native organization, which I think makes perfect sense in my mind, I quickly went to the other stakeholders, youth, a survivor, maybe a tribe. I mean, or, you know, we have 229 here, so that's tricky. And certainly I'm concerned about the costs associated with what we heard from Representative Stapp, given per diem being included and what that sounds like. So I guess, sorry for the long question, but I guess to make it short, defining effective, and secondly, the membership, I think we don't need to address that anymore. I don't think we need to belabor that, but I would like to hear effective because that helps to appreciate the goal.
We'd like to answer that one. Mr. Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Galvin, through the chair. Broadly stated, effective in terms of we have a group of 17 people that have come together now have a like cause, many of which had never met each other before, mm-hmm. many that had. They were focused collectively, and as a result, without additional funding, without additional staff, we've organized to the point where we've completed the council has completed the required reports. It's come up with a list of focus areas, and really brought it to this point where we're before you, where we've done the work that can be done with this passionate group, and this is the next step to move forward, hopefully, so that we can continue the work. We continue to move forward, seek funding, get better organized, get the foundation underneath of this this endeavor to continue to move forward.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Any closing comments, Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank the committee for bringing this forward and so many great questions. Having this many questions, it shows how important this issue is to everyone. And just, again, want to thank the committee and also the current Council on Human and Sex Trafficking for the work that they've done for a very, very long time. And they have been very patient in this process. And I just want to make sure that we recognize the work that they've done in this because it is often a thankless job.
Great. Thank you so very much, Representative Vance, for bringing this bill forward. And so with that, we'll just take a very quick one-minute break to stretch our legs, grab some coffee, and we'll move on to the next bill, which is the PFAS bill, SB 67. So we'll take a brief at ease. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:49 p.m. And our next bill up today is SB 67, and that is the PFAS bill. And I'd like to ask Senator Keel and his staff, Mr. Geckerman, to please come to the table, put yourselves on the record, and introduce your bill. We also have the Department of Environmental Conservation available for questions. I see Ms. Kieneman in the audience. So with that, Senator Keel, if you could please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an honor to be before your committee. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, and I have the privilege of serving Senate District B. Senate Bill 67 deals, as you said, with PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. So what you get when you combine fluorine with hydrocarbons are some of the very strongest bonds in the chemical world. And there are lots and lots and lots of them. We refer to them as a group, as PFAS. As a general rule, they are very slippery. They're waterproof. And the bonds being extremely hard to break, they are very fire resistant. That means they're useful for lots and lots of stuff. And they're very, very hard to get rid of. Unfortunately, they're also very sick. They're also very toxic. They can make people sick. Mr. Chairman, I know the previous bill dealt with a very, very difficult subject. I'm the legislature's other ex officio member of the existing council. And I'm sorry to take you from that heart-wrenching topic to the much lighter topic of poisoned drinking water. But that's really what we're talking about when we talk about the PFAS issue in Alaska today. PFAS, with all those chemical properties I just mentioned, makes a great firefighting substance. Especially when you aerate it up into a foam, it creates a blanket that can go over all kinds of burning things and smother the fire and not break down. The problem we have is that once you do that, out, for instance, on a runway or when you're fighting a fire in the environment, it then gets into the water table, from which many Alaskans get their drinking water. Many states with very heavy manufacturing will have PFAS from those sources. That has not been a significant problem in Alaska. It's primarily firefighting foam. So as we test more and more locations around Alaska where we have used firefighting foam, we are finding, I'm sorry to tell you, more and more locations where there's PFAS contamination in people's drinking water. Causes several types of cancer. Causes thyroid problems. It causes problems in pregnancy, both for mothers and for developing fetuses. So, Mr. Chairman, what Senate Bill 67 does is take a no new spills approach to the problem. It requires anyone with firefighting foam that contains PFAS to make a switch. There are fluorine-free alternatives that are already approved for use in our airports. The FAA has adopted the military specifications. The U.S. Navy took the lead on those. They are particularly interested in the ability to put out jet fuel fires on top of an aircraft carrier real fast. So following the Navy's great work, the FAA has approved these fluorine-free foams that have been in use in other places around the world for many years. So they are commercially available in quantity. Mr. Chairman, the bill does have a delayed implementation for the oil and gas industry. When you think about the great big crude oil storage tanks at Valdez, that is a beast of a different sort. And there are not yet fluorine-free foams that would put out those fires there. So the goal of the bill is to protect health, not to cost lives. It delays implementation for the oil and gas industry until, and we looked around for the best, most apolitical expert we could, until the state fire marshal finds that there is an alternative that works. And even then, there's a full regulation process so that the industry can be involved and comment on implementation timelines for the switch and the like. We thought that was important. I'm pleased to say that the technology is getting close for the oil and gas industry. Several of Alaska's firefighting professionals, including our current fire marshal, are either involved in or are very closely monitoring research going on in Texas and other places. We're just not there yet, and so this bill doesn't mandate a switch until we are there. Mr. Chairman, the next major provision in Senate Bill 67 is the other part of that no new spills goal. Some years back, the state of Alaska, along with the Rasmussen Foundation and the Alaska Village Initiative, a large nonprofit, put together firefighting carts. They called them Code Red carts. They are quite literally carts you can pull behind a four-wheeler, and provided them to 136 rural communities to help them fight fires. Those carts had on them a canister of PFAS-containing firefighting foam concentrate. Today, fully 85% of those carts are broken. You can't fight a fire with them. But the concentrate is still in villages all across Alaska. This bill requires, creates really a take-back provision so that the state of Alaska will ensure that that concentrate gets properly disposed of and is not left in connexes or very small rural villages where there is a risk of spillage should things crack and freeze or any number of other things that can happen when you have non-functional equipment that's left behind in a place with limited resources. Mr. Chairman, that's the heart of the bill. It does need, because this came to your committee last year, it does need two fixes. One, of course, will be the effective date. And the other is that we have been working very closely with the executive branch to tweak some language so that it is acceptable to the administration. I'm pleased to tell you that we received proposed language from the Department of Environmental Conservation today. We have that at Legislative Legal Services to be drafted into an amendment. I'm not prepared to share it with the committee until we have language to show you. But that at work has been collaborative. It has been productive. And I hope to bring the committee that that adjustment to the take-back provision very soon. Mr. Chairman, I know we have invited testifiers who have been on the line for a while. I neglected to introduce John Geckerman, who is in my office through the good auspices of the University of Alaska and Ted Stevens Foundation Legislative Internship Program. He's also prepared to give a sectional analysis at the chairman's discretion.
Okay, thank you. I think it should be fairly short, so maybe let's go ahead and do that, then we'll jump over to invited testimony. Mr. Geckerman, if you could put yourself on the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, John Geckerman, staff to Senator Keel. Section 1 of the bill adds a new section in law. Subsection A prohibits new spraying of PFAS-containing foam unless preempted by the federal government or a fire in the oil and gas industry. Subsection B allows people fighting fires in the oil and gas industry to continue using PFAS-containing foams until an alternative is approved by regulation. Subsection C allows the state fire marshal to write regulations when there are safe fluorine-free foams for the oil and gas industry. Subsection D requires the executive branch to take up to 40 gallons per year of PFAS-containing firefighting foam from Alaskans for disposal. And Section 2 of the bill sets an effective date.
Great, thank you. Maybe before we go to questions, we'll take the invited testimony and then we'll come back to questions. So thank you very much, Mr. Geckerman. We've got first up under invited testimony, Mayor David Pruse, City of Fairbanks. Mr. Pruse, if you could put yourself on the record.
Yes, my name is David Pruse, Mayor of City of Fairbanks. And I'm here on behalf of the City of Fairbanks to speak in favor of Senator Keel's Senate Bill 67. The City of Fairbanks has a PFAS contamination environmental issue. It was basically described as Senator Keel said, firefighters using firefighter foam only. We had a firefighting training center with a containment system, and they would light up oil in the containment system over 30 years and put it out. The containment system didn't fail, but what we found was that the exuberance of the firefighters sprayed outside of the containment system over 30 years. It leached into the water table and then migrated in a northwest path about 4 miles. We've spent approximately $5.4 million in connecting houses to water systems. So they would not be contaminated, but it's something we're still living with. Our fire trucks do not use PFAS. We've changed over that system. So now we're looking at, now I look at it and say, I always say to myself as an elected person, what am I going to do today that might affect us 20 years down the line? And can I stop that? Or is it a good effect? And if you implement this 20 years down the line, you're probably doing something very good for the environment and trying to remove contamination. So I hopefully urge you to accept and approve and pass Senate Bill 67. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Mayor Perus. Next, we'll go up to our other invited testifier, and that is Justin Mack of the Alaska Professional Firefighters. Mr. Mack, if you can also put yourself on the record.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Justin Mack with the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, and I am speaking in favor of SB 67. I want to thank the committee for this opportunity. I currently serve with the Alaska Professional Firefighters, the Vice President of the Anchorage Firefighters Union, State Director of the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, and I'm a captain at Fire Station 3 in Mountain View with the Anchorage Fire Department, where I've been for 13 years. One of the things that I've learned about this profession is just how dangerous it can be. I think we anticipate when we talk about danger going into a burning building, a roof collapse, a commercial building collapse, for example, and those are all real threats that we face on a regular basis, but the one that I didn't understand as a new firefighter was just how exposures might lead to cancer. And ultimately, it's within this realm where we see the highest level of firefighter deaths, and it's directly tied to cancer. So previously, the International Agency for Research on Cancer classified firefighting as possibly carcinogenic, and it has a lot to do with different types of chemicals we're exposed to in the course of our jobs. But the connection back then wasn't as strong as it is now. In 2022, the International Agency for Research on Cancer changed its view and made the occupation of firefighting a group one carcinogen, which means the profession itself is carcinogenic to humans. Group one classification is used when there is the strongest level of evidence that something can cause cancer. So this is really just kind of highlighting the problem we're digging into. And so we start to look at where our exposures come from. And unfortunately, what we see is it comes from many different angles. And what we're learning is it's the foam that we use. It's the PPE turnout gear that we wear is bathed in PFAS is what we're finding. Particulates in a structure fire are seeping through our PPE into our pores, into our skin, and stays there for several days or weeks after fighting a fire. This is the battle we're up against, so it sort of leads us to the PFAS conversation that we're having here today. PFAS, as the senator mentioned, is a broad category, and is one of the areas where we see exposure. As senator mentioned, PFAS firefighting foam works by creating a blanket over a liquid fuel that acts as a barrier preventing flammable vapors from escaping the liquid. This helps both extinguish the fire and to prevent additional ignition of vapors. The problem we're seeing, though, is although PFAS-containing foams are more effective than fluorine-free foams, in numerous studies, PFAS is linked to harmful effects on humans and animals. They do not degrade naturally in the environment. So in response to the negative impacts of PFAS, the Department of Defense in January 2023 issued a new performance specification for firefighting foams used by the military. This specification outlines the functional requirements for firefighting foam used on military bases. These foams must be able to effectively extinguish Class B hydrocarbon liquid fuel fires without containing PFAS. The next step that several groups are working on are what can we add to the fluorine-free foam that's going to increase its effectiveness in fighting fires. And I think that's the project that will be ongoing. And I think once we get deeper and deeper into that, those products will become available for a larger scale, as the senator had mentioned, in the oil and gas industry. But speaking to the health risk, exposure to PFAS has been linked to several issues, including cancer, reproductive problems, immune system disorders, hormonal disruption. and firefighters are at an increased risk of exposure. Legislation is crucial to limit the use of PFAS in firefighting foams and promote the adoption of safer alternatives. By restricting the use of PFAS-containing foams, the legislature can reduce firefighters' exposure to these harmful chemicals and mitigate the environmental impact of PFAS contamination. Additionally, legislation can promote support of PFAS-free firefighting foams that are effective in extinguishing fires without posing health and environmental risk. So in conclusion, addressing firefighter safety concerns surrounding PFAS requires comprehensive legislation to limit the use of PFAS firefighting foams and mitigate their environmental impact by prioritizing adopting safer alternatives and implementing measures to prevent PFAS contamination of drinking water. The legislature can safeguard the health and well-being of firefighters and the communities that we serve.
Great.
And I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mack. I believe there is one question so far. I do also have a quick question. Let's see here. Senator Keel, you mentioned that DEC could take, in the sectional analysis here, it says up to 40 gallons per year of the PFAS foam. And then you had also mentioned, as an example, out in some of our villages, we've got the Code Red kits. How many gallons how big are those? Are those like 5 gallon, 10 gallon? I'm just trying to figure out how many of those kits could be taken back per year if 40 gallons is the cap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Keel, the spec in the bill was written targeted at the Code Red carts. So the Code Red carts had a 5 gallon concentrate. They had a 30 gallon premix tank. So you put that together and 40 gallons just gives you a buffer.
Great. Thank you very much. And I believe Representative Josephson and anybody else, Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Keel, you talked about an amendment, but you mentioned that it was related to the take-back provision. And I thought you were going to say it was to the alternate. The language, in other words, is the administration working with you just on take-back provision language? Excuse my voice. Or is it working with you on the alternative to PFAS itself? Because I know that was a concern in 2023.
Senator Keel?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in answer to Representative Josephson, the amendment language that we received today has to do with the the take-back, the removing the AFFF aqueous PFAS foam from villages, small remote areas. Members of this committee will recall that in the governor's capital budget submittal, there is funding to for DOT to replace PFAS foams at DOT-operated airports, which, by the way, I absolutely applaud. That is the right move. And Alaska Department of Transportation is, I believe, the second largest owner of PFAS foam in the state. So they are on the right track. They are buying the fluorine-free foams. They are doing the responsible thing. And so I hope that addresses your question.
It does.
Thank you.
Any further questions on the bill? I see no questions. Senator Keel, any closing comments before we close out the day?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the committee spending some time on this issue. You have at least one, arguably two, highly knowledgeable members of your committee on this issue. And so I look forward to working with you and your staff and members of the committee to advance this legislation as soon as we have the language from the administration that we can work with you to adopt.
Thank you. Do you know approximately how long it might be before that language comes back?
Mr. Chairman, if I remember Ledge Council policy correctly, the co-chairs of finance committees can move things up Legislative Legal Services priority list.
See, we'll have to reach out to them. Okay, thank you. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 27th at 8:30 in the morning. We will start on amendments for House Bill 268, that's the operating budget, as well as House Bill 270, which is the mental health budget. So start the day early tomorrow, and with that, we will be adjourned at 3:09 p.m. Thank you.